Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's August 29th, 2014. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
It feels like August 29th, doesn't it? It's dog days of summer around here.
but it's funny. It's like I'm getting ready to go to Ohio this week, actually tomorrow. And I always like going back to Ohio during the fall. That's the time I miss Ohio because it's a little cooler and you actually have fall up there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have fall down here. We have summer and summer-ish down
summer
here.
Summer light.
Yeah. And which I love, don't get me wrong, but I really do like the fall up there. So so right now it'll feel a lot more like August, I think, when I get off the plane. But
yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, dog days of summer.
And of course, August in Florida means election season. We have this crazy thing down here where we do primaries like 70 days before the general election.
I know, it's like the signs are always out. It's like there's never a friggin' political sign not on someone's lawn around here. It's
crazy. Well, I mean, you got an election in March, then you got election in August, an election in November. I mean, it never ends.
Yeah. Right?
But I thought this was a funny story I ran across not too long ago. A little city here near us called Palm Harbor. It's actually not really a real city. It's an area. They have an honorary mayor. So this isn't a real election, right? This is something done by the Chamber of Commerce. And ceremonial title and everything. And the winner is not decided by votes. It's decided by who raises the most money for charity.
Very interesting. All right?
So if you go out there and have your lemonade stand and it goes crazy, you're the mayor.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, the story I read detailed the charity strategies of the three candidates this year. And one of them was holding a charity poker tournament to raise money.
Awesome.
Pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
So it got me thinking, and I know this is probably preposterous, but that's why we talk about the show, so you can tell me it's preposterous. But in a real election, do you think we'll ever see anybody try to raise funds for the charity poker tournament?
Scott, that is preposterous. First of all, I know that all of our area poker room managers must have loved that guy showing up and saying, hey, would you hold a charity event of your property for me?
Yeah, it wasn't, though. Was that some?
I know, but I'm sure he probably went to them first, and then they all said no, that's why it wasn't, because those guys hate having to host charity events. But
they don't hate it. It's a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They hate the paperwork, so they hate it. It's like transitive property. You ever go to Algebra 101 or whatever?
That's when I went from a math poker player to a field poker player. Algebra 2.
Here's the deal. I mean, I think it has to be preposterous to do this for a real candidate because this is one way that they could just make it like unlimited rebuys for the first day. And then some guy could just keep contributing as much money as he wants to your campaign. And there's no ramifications for it.
I mean, the reason it probably wouldn't happen outside of just, I don't think anybody would go that route anyhow. But I mean, you would have to abide by campaign finance laws. So
they could all max out then.
Well, no, but if you buy in, you got to register with your name and address just like you would if you, you know, send $100 to your favorite candidate for governor, right? So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there'd be a lot more paperwork involved. And you're right. If it's a rebuy, you know, once you hit 3,000 or whatever the individual limit is on donating to that candidate, you're done. And that's probably a nightmare. But that's a logistical problem, though. I'm talking about, sitting around the war room and going, man, we're getting outspent on TV. I know. Let's have a charity poker tournament. Raise some more money.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably no. Not. I mean, especially because if the charity tournament, then some money's going to the charity and not to him, unless he is the charity, and he can't
be
that's
a charity. What I'm saying. It's the non-profit organization.
Non-profit.
Raising money for,
I don't think
his campaign,
so.
Right?
Yeah, that'd be hilarious, though, to see, like, the commercials for it and stuff. You know, Rick Scott held a charity poker tournament, you know, while others were starving in Bangladesh. He, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it's just, I don't think that could ever possibly happen. Plus, I still think there's a stigma attached to poker.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the reason, right?
Yeah. But that is pretty funny. And I wonder, did you find out, like, if how much money he raised from the tournament and stuff?
Well, no, the story was August 14th, so that was, like, 13 days ago. I don't know when it actually was. I'm sorry. But I'll research that. I'll get back to the...
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure people are just waiting with bated breath listening to our show and wondering what that was. I was just curious if it was successful. Because maybe it does. Like, now it starts... Maybe it'll be a tradition every year that whoever runs for that ceremonial title, maybe we'll do something like that. And all of a sudden, it'll be annual and... And then all of a sudden, now you've got this big tournament going on or whatever to raise money. That'd be kind of cool if something like that started from it. But
well, yeah, I think part of this was the personality of the person. I mean, it's none of these people just said, hey, I've got a little cup outside my office. Come drop money in it. You know, they're all – it's an actual campaign and finding a way to make it creative. You know, like the this ice bucket thing that you're probably not aware of because you're not on Facebook. But
no, my family's made it all too – yeah.
But I mean, that's a campaign, right? Of a sense. So I mean, they got creative and did something that took off, and I think that's the whole idea behind this. Is just to, for these candidates not to just raise money, but to raise money in a creative way.
Yeah.
Scott
decided
a charity poker tournament is the way to go.
Pretty
so
cool.
Next year's candidates may not be.
We'll see. We'll
poker
see.
Savvy.
Never know.
Yeah. All right. Well, this was announced a long time ago, back during our binge break. Remember the binge break?
No. I don't remember it. I wasn't here.
But it's a good story. I think it's still worth discussing, even though we're a little behind the times on it. Our good friend Alex Dreyfus, who owns the Global Poker Index, which runs the standings for ANIA Poker Tour. He also bought the Hendon Mob recently. And now he's bought the European Poker Awards and plans to host an American Poker Awards ceremony in Los Angeles this February. So what do we think about this? American Poker Awards.
I love it. Anything that promotes our industry and our sport or our hobby or whatever you want to call it positively and gets people excited about it and gets people, you know, maybe voting or visiting, you know, websites to, you know, increase traffic and awareness, absolutely love it. I mean, it could be really fun. You know, they could be biggest bluff. You know, who knows what he's going to make them. But I love the idea of... Of just a, you know, I mean, you see the awards season on TV and stuff like that, and you're like, oh, no, the Screen Actors Guild Awards, and oh, the, you know, the Publix supermarket sponsored, you know, who cares? I mean, but, you know, something like this where there is sort of like, you know, there is no, you know, way to, you used to have like in the magazines a couple where maybe they still have them in other magazines, and you've done some in the past. But I like it. I like anything that can bring us on a, you know, all in a better light and positive is fine by me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned sport in that because another thing that he just came out with this week is somebody, one of these bloggers on the real popular blogging sites, not a poker site, but you know, I don't know if it's HuffPo or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
did a real casual survey of things that aren't sports, but the participants consider themselves athletes, something to that extent, right?
Right.
And it was a huge line of things. And the very last one, and it was a huge line, I mean, long, was poker. Got the smallest support for being a sport, right? And of course, you know, poker players went, you know, batshit crazy over this. And I'm like, dude, it was like 300 people that voted on this thing. Let's relax a little bit.
Yeah.
But Alex really got worked up about this, and now he's like, you know, why can't poker be a sport? So now he's starting some kind of campaign and some other things to really get people to see poker as a sport. So that's the new thing that he's doing as well too. But I guess what I like about this is that you're right. I mean, we've done our own kind of awards in our magazine. Other magazines have too. And you can't really do that because, I mean, how many times have we talked about how we won the Bluff Reader's Choice for podcast?
Right.
Until we started a magazine, and then we ceremoniously never made it, the nomination list, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the same way. I mean, I get it. I mean, I think Alex is still in this position where he's to some degree impartial enough to pull off a true awards.
Yeah.
And I have no idea whether these awards will include Best Magazine or anything like that. I don't think so. I think they're more player awards. But he's in the position to kind of pull that off and have, you know, some legitimacy where people aren't criticizing the source of the awards.
Right.
And I think he's also put some time into really trying to set it up correctly. I mean, we still don't know what categories and things like that he's going to come up with, but he's trying to put together a good cross section of voters that, you know, from different areas and expertise, so it's, you know, transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And people asked him, I mean, there's a good interview on Poker News, by the way, if folks want to check that out about this. And they asked him why the ceremony's in Beverly Hills instead of Las Vegas, which seems to make the most sense. And I think originally he was talking about doing it during the World Series of Poker, you know, when everybody's out there. But he thought this thing is actually bigger than, not the, bigger than the World Series, but it's big enough to stand on its own and it would get lost during the World Series. And said that, you know, hey, all the award shows come from L.A., so why shouldn't ours be out there?
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
I mean, it's like little tiny things like that that I think show that he's putting some, you know, some thought into it and give me some hope that it's going to be, you know, fun, like you said, but also maybe meaningful and people will actually care about it. So.
Sounds like fun. I mean, it should be pretty cool. And on a side note, Alex, you're buying up all these things. So, you know. My email is chris@antiupmagazine.com. Shoot us an email. Make us an offer.
Oh, what's funny about that is I'm Facebook friends with him, right? And about a month ago, he's like, 2 years ago, we bought the Hindemom. Last year, we bought the European Poker Awards. What should I buy this summer? And almost went, I'm not saying that Antiup's for sale, but I'm saying Antiup could be for sale.
I'm not going to be rude and not listen to your offer. Nor will I be rude and not accept it. No, of course we're not selling Antiup. Unless somebody offers us money. Okay. You know, you mentioned that binge break that we had. And I think while it was, while we were on the binge and,
yep.
You know, that period where I found this story. And it's not really poker related, but I just thought it was funny. Scott was so happy and loving these binge ideas and doing binging on his own with Netflix or whatever. There was a story that had a new study in the Journal of American Heart Association that said that people who watch 3 or more hours of TV a day or possibly sit and listen to 3 or more hours of podcasts a day may double the risk of early death. So we have somehow, maybe, if you add up all 5 of our episodes, we could have contributed to the early death of the Antiup Nation. So I feel bad. Now, the study pretty much said was, you know, because you sit there for 3 hours.
Yep.
So it depends on, yeah, exactly. So it depends on how you're listening to our show. If you're jogging, don't worry about it.
Yep.
If you're riding in the car, well, you would have been riding in the car anyway, so you can't put it on us. But if you're stopping your day, if you're listening to the 3 hours of our show or all shows, yeah, find another way to listen to the show.
With a big bowl of nacho chips.
Yeah, exactly.
A big cheese, yeah.
Yeah,
we're not going to pass the presidential fitness test.
I'd like to die with a clear conscience, so please find a better way to listen to us than to sitting there with a big vat of nacho cheese. You know, but the good thing is we only do one a week, so I mean they really have to binge, you know, all the time.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I don't think we could do that. Although, if you
it's
went
just
back
that one time a year, that we do the binge. That's...
Yeah, but you know the thing is though is if you wanted to. You could go all the way back to episode 1 when we were at the Times, and you could probably binge for a good couple of weeks straight.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? How many shows we've done. I mean, we're coming up on 500 pretty soon, and that's a lot of shows.
Mm-hmm.
So, not that I'm trying to teach you how to kill yourself by listening to our show early, or kill yourself early, but I just thought that was funny. Well, during binge week, I found that story about binging.
You know, maybe that's the new Phil Lack endurance challenge. Instead of how long he can play at the poker table, it's how long he can continually listen to Antiup podcasts before falling asleep.
Before falling asleep.
Or dying at the heart of the Journal of the American Heart Association.
Could that be like a Guinness thing that we, you know, we get
oh,
there
it
and have them say, okay, who's listened to the longest Antiup, streaming of all time, and everybody, and you could tie for the world record and break it every week. You could just sit around waiting for the newest episode and continue to break your record. I mean, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could have, it'd have to be a really long cruise, right? But we could do that on a cruise, maybe.
Wow. Sit by the pool with your headset and the whole week just sit there and listen.
They'd do it in the poker room so we could watch it, you know. So you could just have to sit there and...
sit there in the corner of the poker
room. Exactly, yeah. That'd be a very exciting cruise. Your wife would love you. but yeah, you could win a world record, so...
What episode are you on now? It's the Pod-Ons. I can't do it. I can't go on.
Oh my God, they're replaying the Pod-On show. Why would they do that?
Why didn't he screw up that episode during the binge?
Oh man, can you imagine that though? You're walking around, you're going back home. Hey, Joe, I heard you set a world record. I did. Well, what was it in? Listen to the longest continually running poker cast on the planet for the longest continually amount of time. And they just walk away disgusted. Yeah, that's not worthy.
You're not worthy. All right. Each week we spotlight a listener who calls our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emails us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we'll do with Call of Four and Hand of the Week, we send them something fantastic. By the way, I want to thank Austin Bluffs for actually calling the hotline.
Yes.
No one calls our hotline. And I'm wondering if it's because we changed the number or if it's just nobody's listening. I don't know. But, I mean, it's starting to get frustrating when no one actually listens to the hotline and or uses the hotline, I mean. And we've been doing a lot of, like, emails for the spotlight lately. And I'm getting tired of listening to Scott calling once a month and saying, this is a test. This is a test of the hotline. And then I'm thinking, oh, we finally get a call. And then, oh, it's Scott.
Yeah. No, you got to do that once a month or they take it away.
Yeah. So that's how few calls we're getting, because Scott has to call once a month to make sure that... So, guys, start calling the hotline and give us something to put on the show for the hotline. Otherwise, I'm going to bug Scott to stop doing it. But Austin Bluffs calls in, and I really like this point.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one.
Yeah, so let's hear what he has to say.
Hey, guys, this is Austin Bluffs, and I'd like to call and get some insight or what you guys think about bad beat jackpots. I'd prefer not to play for a bad beat jackpot, and if I did, I'd prefer to pay only $1 for a rake instead of $2, which is what they charge in my local rooms here in Black Hawk, Colorado. But when I was in my local card room this weekend, I noticed when I was reading the rules about the bad beat jackpot, it said that they would rake the pot for $1 when the pot got up to $6, and then they'd rake the other $2, the second dollar when the pot got to $20. And it requires a $20 minimum pot to hit the bad beat jackpot. So to me, it seems kind of unfair that you could contribute $1 to the pot that goes to the bad beat jackpot when the pot gets from $6 to $19, but you're not eligible to collect on that bad beat jackpot. So I was just curious what your thoughts were on that, if you think it's unfair and why players would let the poker rooms get away with that. And if they did want to charge it that way, why don't they just charge $2 at $20? So at least only the eligible people are being charged for it. And I'm just curious if the poker room managers you talk to have any thoughts on this and whether they still think large bad beat jackpots are a draw to the rooms.
Wow. I mean, I could talk forever about this. So don't let me talk forever because, you know, we're trying to keep the show.
Well, I'll cut you off when you make something a poignant point.
Anyway, I definitely want to get back to his initial idea, what we think about bad beat jackpots, but I don't want to forget to discuss his last point, which I think is really important. That he mentioned that they take $1 at six and a second at 20, but the pot has to have $20 in it to be eligible. Because this is something I think that the players really get confused about. And I actually got a call from a reader/listener, I think, this week. He actually called me up and said, Scott, you got to explain this to me. Because she was wondering when she plays at different rooms around here in the Tampa Bay area and they take those dollars at different times. And that's what I told her, is that there's no regulation on that. Every room takes those dollars at different periods. I mean, some take the first one at 20 and then take another one at 40. I've actually never heard one taken at 6 and second at 20 like this one. But they're allowed to do that. And what I would say to Austin specifically on his example is, I'm not familiar with the room he's talking about, but my guess would be that in addition to the Bad Beat Jackpot in that room, they do other player-funded promotions, you know, like a high hand or stuff like that. Right. And I suspect that the first dollar goes to those promotions, and that's why it comes out at $6, and you're probably eligible for whatever those things are with a pot of $6. And the Bad Beat Jackpot dollar is that second one that's taken at 20, and that's why there has to be $20 in the pot to be eligible for that jackpot. That would be my guess, but he would have to ask and find out. But yeah, that's why when people sit around and grumble, why is there going to be $20 in the pot to be jackpot eligible? It's because they don't take a dollar out of the pot until that point. So, yeah, and if you're not funding the jackpot, you can't win the jackpot. Make sense?
Yes.
All right, so I think that's the important thing for folks to understand, too, because that comes up, too, when you ask for that rake reduction. You know, everybody, we only got four players, a rake reduction. All right. But if you're one of those players that's sitting in the room trying to win the Bad Beat jackpot, you never want to ask for the rake reduction, right?
Right, because they're not going to
because now you're not jackpot eligible. Yeah. So, you know, if you're just playing, that's a different story. But I think I've made my views on the Bad Beat jackpots pretty clear on the show in the past, or certainly for readers of the magazine. I am very anti-Bad Beat jackpot. I don't think it's good for players, and I don't think it's good for the rooms, and here's why. It's because it takes a dollar or two out of every pot and locks it away for long periods of time. You know, because these Bad Beat jackpots, to make them attractive, have to have hard qualifiers, right? So yeah. Usually it's quads beaten by quads, or at least a really high ace, aces full.
Right.
Some rooms, it's like quad tens beaten by something else. So, and that's why you get these $300,000, $400,000 jackpot. That money is out of the poker economy the entire time. You know, and when you take money off the table, you know what that means? That means the games dry up. So even though these big numbers seemingly attract people, they're really killing the game until it's while it's going on. I'm a much bigger fan of quick turnaround, high hand jackpots, $100 here, and you have poker cruises, you know, things like that. because one, they're quick and they get the money back out, and two, particularly like those high hand things, that money goes right back on the table. I mean, how many times have you seen somebody hit a high hand for $100 and not put that money right back on the – literally right back on the table in front of them, right?
It has to.
It depends on the room.
Well, every room I've ever been at, they have to put it in front of the person because they want to.
The point is, if you hit a Bad Beat jackpot of $365,000, that's not going on the table, right?
No.
Where's that money going? That guy's going to go out and he's going to buy a house. He's going to buy a car. He's going to make sure his kids get through college. All great things. None of that benefits the poker economy. None of it. That money is lost forever. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. And, you know, most of the – I think he also asked about what managers said, and I think the pendulum is swinging now. I mean, I travel a lot. I talk to a lot of managers. There's a lot more of them now, I think, that realize the Bad Beat jackpots are bad for business and are getting away from it and getting it more into these other kind of things. And the ones that are still holding on keep telling me, hey, Scott, when my Bad Beat jackpot's up to $400,000, this place is packed. And I'm like, you're right. How packed is it the day after it hits? Well, no one's really here. That's right. So you have a real solid week, month, even 3 months if you get lucky. And then it's crickets until you get that jackpot back up, you know, because no one – once the pot hit at $460,000, no one's excited to come back in tomorrow and get $25,000 for the same thing, right?
Right.
It takes a while to build back up. I don't think it's good business, and I don't think players should like them. And I think if your favorite room is taking a jackpot drop, you really should encourage them to find ways to get it back into the poker economy and back quickly.
Yeah, you sold me. I mean, I was never really for it. Maybe I was. Maybe I thought it was kind of cool at the idea of hitting it for yourself because that's what you know, it's like playing the lottery.
And
that's why you're doing it, for the one individual who wins it. But for the overall community, that's the thing. Like, imagine if your poker room dried up and died because of something like that. Would you still think it was great? You can never play poker there again.
Yep.
You know, and then if you don't hit, nah, you didn't hit and you didn't hit on the poker room. So I'm sold on it now. I used to kind of be on the fence about it, but I'm totally with you on that now. I really am. And it sucks when we agree on things, but no, you're absolutely right. So, Austin, thanks for calling, buddy. Really appreciate you calling the line. And, you know, it's Guys, start calling the line some more. Otherwise, we're not going to have any audio clips anymore.
206-338-6344.
That's right. All right, call the floor. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com and we'll have Annie Up Poker Tour Tournament Director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This comes from Sean. He says, I was playing a 9-person 6-12 limit hold'em game in Minnesota.
I love that.
I know. Where is that around here, man? We need that.
It's not. That's why I love Minnesota.
He said he was sitting in seat 4 and the dealer button was in seat 9. Dealer deals everyone their first card, and as he comes around with the second cards, he accidentally slings my second card to seat 5. This player has not touched his cards, and my second card lands on top of his first card. I could easily see which card was mine. Instead of moving the misdealt card from seat 5 to me, or just clearing a misdeal, the dealer simply said, oops, threw me the next card out of the deck, and continued dealing the rest of the whole cards to seat 6 through 9. I didn't make a huge think about it since my first card was a 3, and I was unlikely to play the hand regardless of what my second card was. Also, nobody else at the table so much as raised an eyebrow. Perhaps if it was for higher stakes or at a crucial junction in a tournament, I would have acted differently. But the longer I sat there, the more I wondered what the correct call should have been.
And that's why you send it in for call 4, because Sam will tell you what the correct call should have been. And this is what Sam says for this one. This was definitely not the correct outcome. I hope seat 5 didn't win this hand. What should happen every time is you were supposed to get the card off the deck that was intended for you. If there's no way to determine which card it was due to commingling, then all the cards come back and we reshuffle and deal again. Oops is definitely not the way to handle this. The next time you play in this establishment, I would notify the floor to what happened so they can properly inform their dealers on how to correctly handle this situation in the future.
Okay, here
we go.
We're
a bit of a destiny thing, right?
Here goes Chris's rant now. See, Scott had his, now I have mine. Why is it card destiny there? I mean, I'm happy with it. I think that's a correct. But why is it that people get all bent out of shape when you're talking about card destiny? It's the same thing when somebody flops something by accident. They're like, wait, you're dealt too many cards. And then they make them redo them back onto the deck in the exact same order they threw them out before they do the flop. And I'm like, no. Why? What happened to card destiny, right? You don't care about card destiny. But all of a sudden, people care about card destiny, and I always get the guff for this, but here's Sam, one of the most decorated poker people on the planet, telling you it's card destiny. Why do I get guff for this, but other people can say it?
All right, this is a thin argument, I admit, but I'm going to make a case as to why this is different than the normal card destiny crowd.
Okay.
Of which you absolved yourself of recently. So now you're back on it. I don't know.
No, but I'm just curious as to once I got off the damn freaking thing, now I get this in my face, and I'm like, see?
I would say this is more for an establishment integrity reason rather than a card destiny reason.
Okay.
Because if you're playing in a room where the dealers, and let's be honest, this doesn't happen often, so I'm not suggesting that this dealer does this all the time. But if you're sitting in that room and a dealer sloppily deals and just says, oh, hey, you take whatever card you guys want, that reflects poorly on the established, not just from the poor dealing, but the integrity. How do I know that the dealer is in cahoots with this player over here? And that's why you have the burn card and all that kind of stuff, right? So I think it's more for that reason than the destiny. I don't think it's you're supposed to have that card or the Jupiter's going to fall out of alignment thing. I think it's just, hey, we need to protect the integrity of this. I think that's a different thing than the flop or that kind of stuff.
See, I agree, but I think they go hand in hand.
They probably do.
I really think the destiny and the integrity go hand in hand, and that's why I kind of lose it when I think, wait a minute, that is my card. That is what I'm supposed to get. They're shuffled. Why are we shuffling then? You know what I mean? So that's how I feel, and I mean, I've gotten past it. I let bygones be bygones. When they're at a table and it happens, I don't say anything because apparently I'm in the minority, but every time I'm in the minority, something like this comes up. So I think they go hand in hand, and I'm glad he made that ruling because it just reaffirms what I always felt about the cards, especially when they're being dealt. It's one thing to be like, oh, okay, you can shuffle the stub whenever you feel like it, if you want to, when you want to do the flop, like they've done in cash games for years, you know, the big games where, like, if they suspect something, they're like, go ahead and shuffle the stub because I don't believe, you know, whatever bull that they pull there. But, you know, to me, when you're dealing the cards, why'd you shuffle then? you shuffled because you wanted to mix them, and why are they in that order? Why aren't you dealing from the middle? And the, you know, because there's integrity involved with the deck. It's not. So I'm glad this ruling came. It just makes me feel a little bit better about the way I've behaved in the past.
I don't know if anything can make me feel better about the way
I've behaved. Oh, jeez. You know, you know, I can lob them up there, and you can miss once in a while, just like your Devil Rays.
They're not the Devil Rays.
Yeah, I know. They're the Rays, but they'll always be the Devil Rays to me. I don't know why. Hey, we get to complete O'Malley's move today. Very exciting stuff. Let's hear part one again.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're sitting 2-5 No Limit Hold'em, and we're about even with 492. The table's been pretty solid so far, a lot of steals and a lot of raise and take it situations. It's a full 9-handed table, and we've been playing for 3 hours. The blind's post, and it's folded around to the MP, who makes a standard raise to $20. This player is pretty solid as well. We've seen him make good calls and what we can assume were good folds, but for the most part, he hasn't shown down a ton of hands. He sits with about 1,200. He also bought in for 500 and has been here just 15 minutes less than we have. Up to this point, we've tried to avoid him. We're in the cutoff, and we look down at the Queen of Spades, Queen of Diamonds. This is a good hand pre-flop and one we don't want to play timidly. We want to find out where he's at, get heads up, and see what the flop brings. We raise the bet to $50. The action is folded back around to the MP, who thinks for a short time before calling the bet. With about $100 in the pot, the flop comes the 7 of diamonds, 4 of spades, deuce of spades. This is a pretty safe flop, and fortunately we have position. Our opponent once again thinks for a short time before counting out a neat $60 and placing it into the pot. So we have an overpair. Are we beat? And if not, what are we going to do?
All right, well, obviously the scary hands are ace, ace, king, king, or a set. I think all are possible based on how this hand is played, especially with the two spades on the board now. It's also possible that he puts us on a big ace and wants to see if we're just c-betting, you know, that good old testing raise, right?
Yeah.
Our hand is too strong to turtle at this early. I mean, we got queens here, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to raise to $200 and show this dude we mean business, and he can show me that he means business if he wants.
Yes, I'm likely to play ABC here too, if I'm actually in this position and I'm not, you know, having my views here tainted by the fact that it's an O'Malley's move. Because since it's O'Malley's move, he almost never, ABC almost never is the result. You know what I mean? The right play is, you know, always something different or whatever. So let's try something different and call. Keep the pot manageable and see what happens later. But I don't know. Well, I always try to, and the other thing too is I'm influenced by your answer first. So I try to do something different.
As you should be.
Yeah. So, but I mean, if I'm at the table, I'm probably raising because I got the overpair. But With O'Malley, you never know. So I'm trying to guess what happens here, and I'm just going to call. Let's see what happens.
Hello again. Let's look at his pre-flop action to try to determine what his possible range could be. Unless he's running a trap, we can rule out aces or kings, because he merely called our pre-flop re-raise. He could have flopped a set here, but I'm thinking that's probably a monster-under-the-bed scenario. I'm betting he either has a pair, lower than our queens, but still over the board. Ace-king, ace-queen, or perhaps some kind of a draw. Maybe spades? If it's any of these hands, the right bet will probably get him out, and we kind of just want to end it right here. There's 160 in the pot, and we make it 200 to go. We want to let him know that at this point, we'll put it all in if he raises us. Our opponent does exactly what we anticipated, looks at our stack, measuring it up, counts the pot, and then folds. We take it down. Until next time, I am Malcolm O'Malley saying, don't forget your opponent's pre-flop actions. You need all the information to put together a logical story. I hope to see you on the felt.
He shoots, he scores! I called the exact raise amount, and you guys will all have to believe me on this one. But the result as well, too. I really thought that raise was going to get this guy to fold because he was just, you know, posturing with us. And this might be the first time for me in O'Malley's Move history that I got everything correct.
I'm just going to let you have your moment here.
Aw, thanks, buddy.
I mean, I thought maybe it was just the old Brunson move. You know, betting into the re-raiser, and yeah. So maybe we'll call. We'll try something different, but you hit it right in the head. And it has nothing to do with the fact that O'Malley sent us part two with part one. Listen
no,
to
of
it.
Course not. No.
No, but that's
the one
good.
Thing I will say, too, is that I did jump into my answer a little too early. He's right. I think that – I'm not necessarily thinking that King wouldn't have played it this way, but he's right. Ace-Ace wasn't going to let us just raise and not re-raise,
right.
Generally speaking, I think. King might just, concerned that we have ace-ace and see how it plays out. But he's right. And now that I think of it, the way he explained that, too, that makes it even less likely that we're up against something that's got us crushed. So
yeah.
Makes me more confident in my correct move here.
I mean, it could have been, like I said, it could have been a set, you know, knowing that we had an overpair betting into us to see us come over the top, you know, and... That's the old Brunson move where you bet into the razor.
Well, yeah, and exactly. And I guess what I was saying is that's why I raised the 200 to show him we mean business. And if he wants to show me he means business, I'm going to have to respect it at that point, I think.
Can you get away from it at that point?
Well, I mean, yeah, would we start with?
Let's like
see. 490. We have 492, right? Yeah. So, and the preflop was, what, 50? So we had
442, and you bet 200.
442, so 200 left.
A huge pot.
I think I could... I'm not saying I would.
Yeah, I don't think I would.
I think the raise is enough that it gets the desired effect that we want, which is to show me mean business and it'll fold, but also leaves me an out to decide whether or not. And that's, I mean, really, that's tough at that point, right? Isn't it? That's the gut check here.
Yeah.
This is why the pros are so successful, right? Because they do this stuff all the time, right?
Yeah.
You know, 3-bet, 4-bet, 5-bet, and it's all a game of chicken. It really is. And that's exactly what's going on here. I mean, I'm raising him because I really think that he thinks that we missed this flop, and he's hoping that we'll turtle, like I said. And we're showing him, hey, you know, I'm not turtling. And then if he raises again now, you know, is he doing this? Because he thinks, well, now he's got a fold now that I'm putting them all in. Or does that mean that, hey, I got a live one here. I got my set, and I'm going to crush this guy.
Yeah. And
I really don't know.
It's funny. The reason I put the answer that I did, too, was I was at Foxwoods years ago, and I had pocket queens. It's almost exactly like this hand where I raised preflop, and a guy called. And or it may have been like a raise and I re-raised, and then the guy who had raised originally called me, and the flop came something very similar, but it was like 8-4 deuce, and he bet out. I raised, he shoved, I called, and he had pocket eights, and he made it set. And so you can see it when you play it back in your head. You can see it. The guy bets out to see if we really did have an overpair or we're going to raise, because right. If we had nothing, we're not going to get anything out of us anyway. So he bet out. I raised him. He knew he had me with an overpair, and he knew he was going to get all my money. So he said, why not just put it all in here? He did. I followed through. It was like a $200 shove or something. So the pot was like almost $500 by the time we were done. And I lost. I lost it all. And I was like, damn, how did he call my raise with eights? But now I know why. That's why. He knew that I was the type of player that was probably only raising with a good pair. And if he could flop a set, he'd get my whole stack. And so that was the sort of Brunson move there where he bets into me to see if I really do have that overpair. To get all my money, whereas if he checked, and then he might milk a little bit out of us, but if the board gets scarier as it goes along, mm-hmm. He's going to lose us. So that's what and kid played it really well against me. It was pretty textbook, really, for getting a whole stack of somebody in a cash game, but it worked out for him, and that was why I kind of thought, let's just call here, and something scary comes, I can get away from it, but there's no way I get away from it if I put your 200 out there and the guy comes over the top. I'm not getting away from that hand.
Our stuff. I mean,
yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm not saying you can, but
I've got five hands that have you crushed right there. So
yeah, I wouldn't get away from it though.
Yep,
I'm too weak. I suck.
You're weak. You're pathetic, and you're weak.
I am pathetic, and I'm weak.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is J Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. Check out J Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. And I got to say, I forgot to mention this last week when we talked about the Dr. Frankie coming over to play Chinese. He was the original guy that introduced us. The J Design, remember?
Yeah, that's correct.
He actually bought them online and brought them to home game. We all fell in love, and next thing I know, I'm reaching out to Jason at J Design, and we've become friends. And now, you know, we're using his cards on our cruises and giving away on the show. And you know, his new design that came out, which has been, I want to say, a while now, but it didn't come out last week. It's been
right. It's been a little while.
Several months, or even maybe even a year. We were trying to figure out. But obviously he's very appreciative of Frank buying that first deck and introducing us, because, you know, it's been good for him, right?
Yeah.
And so when he sent us the last shipment of cards for our cruise, he's like, you know, would you mind giving a setup to Frank? Because I'm sure he's really going to like the new design. And it's been sitting on my nightstand ever since he shipped that to us. Because Frank and I haven't been at the same home game in however long.
Jeez.
It might even be a year, we were talking. We're not sure. I don't think it's been that long, but eventually I gave it to him when he came over to play Chinese, and he's very excited to have me. Loves him. The new design, it's really cool. So.
I can tell you when it was. It was his house spring training. It was just starting spring training, or just starting the start of the season this year, because we were talking about Rays.
That's probably
baseball.
Right, because yeah,
and you were sitting on my left.
I wouldn't take it. I would forgot to take the cards there because I wouldn't see him.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was.
It's probably been a year since he's been
at your house. Yeah,
my house. Yeah.
Jeez, man, crazy. Time flies. Yeah.
But anyhow, that's how this stuff works. People find great cards, they introduce you to other people, and people do business and have fun. And I'm not just saying this for our sponsor's sake, but I know people love, our listeners love this J Design stuff.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. They're gorgeous.
Love to get these cards and the uncut sheets and things like that. So it's been good for all of us, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so this comes from Jason. He's written before, so I don't know. He's probably corrected this. Is it Kibby or Kib?
I would say it's Kibby.
Kibby, all right. Anyway, I'm sorry, Jason, but you know the risk when you send a Hand of the Week to Scott Long. He's going to have no clue how to say your name, so I apologize. all right, so he says, my friend recently played World Series of Poker event number 51, the No Limit Hold'em Monster Stack.
Wow.
And side note, too, one of our former columnists and really good all-around guy, Jonathan Little, writes really good, honest blog stuff, I think. Folks should go check it out. He had a great, great blog post about the Monster Stack recently, and why this is the worst tournament for amateur players to play at the World Series, which is exactly what I thought, but it's nice that a pro actually confirms my thoughts and was nice enough to tell everyone, hey, I'm just going to take your money in this thing, so quit doing it. And, I mean, his point was that the shorter stack ones are harder for pros to play. And when you give people, pros, more chips, they have a bigger advantage over you.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, people got all crazy over the Monster Stack because the stacks are like what they normally play in their home tournaments, their home casino tournaments. And really, that's a bad thing, in his opinion.
I'm starting to feel like this show is turning into one of those daily affirmations with Stuart Smalley or whatever. It's like everything that we've done today has kind of affirmed our, you know. You know, I got the guy, you know, let's see, we got Sam confirming my destination. We've got you guessing exactly what O'Malley's move bet and result was going to be. Now you've got Jonathan Little backing you up on the monster. I mean, it's crazy. It's
yeah.
Like we need a little loving or something this week, so
we're
just
getting there.
You're good, and gosh darn it, people like you.
Oh man! All right, so as he was explaining, this is a regular $1,500 buy-in No Limit Hold'em event. A regular there one there, you start with 4,500 chips, right? Three times the buy-in is what they normally do at the World Series. But the Monster Stack, they started you with 15,000 in chips. So again, people went gaga because they thought it was a deep stack when really it wasn't. And it says, with lots of chips to start with and regular blind levels, my friend thought this would be a positive EV event and decided to take a shot at it. And of course, again, I will defer Jonathan Little to explain why that may or may not be correct. Obviously, we don't know how experienced his friend is. But right. if you're an amateur, you're going to want to avoid the monster stack next year and play one of the general ones. Jason says he has had some success both online and in live events. So okay. there you go. Okay. It's back in that favor, right?
Yeah.
So probably was a good choice for him. All right, so now Jason is changing to first-person point of view, but he says, I promise I wasn't playing really, so there's not going to be any switcheroo at the end of this hand.
All right, so still his friend, but we're still just going to say playing, we and yeah, I kind of thing.
Hero, okay. all that kind of stuff, right?
Yep. All right.
We're in level 3, which is 5,100, and we have 13,100, slightly down from the starting stack of 15,000. Nothing too tricky about the players at the table so far. And after 3 limpers, we are in the small blind with ace queen offsuit. Go.
Yeah, I'm going to be out of position for the rest of this hand if I play it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to want to make it a bigger raise than normal. And if you got 3 limpers, you're going to make it even bigger than that. So I really want to just take this down right now. Glad I've picked up the blinds for a few levels because of the limpers and just move on. Because after this, now I'm going to be, you know, in position. And so here's the deal. Usually you make it 300 when there's no limpers. When you got 3 limpers, you're going to add 300 to that. You're going to make it 600. Plus, I'm out of position the rest of the way. I just wanted to end this hand. I might make it like 750 or so, something like that. I want this to be like, you know, if I got the hand, I want to go heads up and at least hope I hit the flop too. But I really don't want. I don't want anybody in this hand. I really want to just move. I hate ace queen. Mm-hmm. I would contemplating folding it if I knew that these people were quality players or whatever. But since they were limping, it's hard to imagine we're behind anybody right now except maybe baby pairs or something. So I really want this hand to end. And if not, I want to be heads up with somebody and then continuation bet and hope I take it down because I'm out of position. The hand's not that great. But it's worthy of a raise, I think. So maybe 750.
Okay. What I really like about this hand is that I'm going to analyze this 2 different ways. I mean, one, this is the general ace queen and small blind situation that we find ourselves in. But I think it's important for us to also to remember that we're in this monster stack tournament, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how that changes play or the perception of our players in that tournament. So if you made a 750, a raise to 750, which I have no problem with, in a normal World Series event where you started with 4,500 in chips, that is substantial, is it not?
It is.
And it is probably going to do exactly what you want to do, which is end it right now and take this money, correct?
Yeah.
I think the problem is now that we're in this monster stack, 15,000, and every player at the table, whether it's right or not, thinks that they've got a crap ton of chips. Right?
Yeah.
So I think that race of 750 is nowhere near as effective in this tournament as it would be in the regular tournament. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense, but I still think it's effective.
It's less effective.
It is less effective.
Right?
That's correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's my fear is that it's less effective and you were right from the beginning. We are out of position with a hand that's really tricky to play. And I do want to take it down right now if I'm going to take it down. And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that 750, even though that's a very acceptable bet here, is going to work here. I think we're going to get 1 or 2 callers here, and then we're going to be in trouble. So I think that means the choice, again, this is for this tournament, I think that choice leaves us to 1 or 2 choices. I think we need to bet even bigger than that. We got to bet something that's really going to make people think. Or probably what I would do here is just call. Just limp along and hope I hit. And if I don't hit, I fold. And that way I've only committed another 50 units to this pot. If I get lucky and hit, you know, 2 pair or a queen high board or something like that, then I can feel more confident. If not, then it's 50. It's 50 well spent at that point for me. And I think I would rather go that route than make this like 1,000 to go or something.
Hmm.
I knew I could get that Christmas sense of,
well, no, I mean, I can see what you're saying. It's just that no matter what, if you're putting that 50 in, you're never going to be comfortable with any flop other than something monster like ace queen.
That's
so why play the hand?
Correct. Perfectly correct. But that doesn't mean you can't win this hand still. It just means that you've lost the ability to be the aggressor.
Yeah, that's true. And you can never
still
take control of
the
hand.
Still means that even with
again.
A queen high flop here, you still could win this hand.
Absolutely.
You're not
going to
come out firing and being as confident as you would have been had you made that raise preflop. I agree with that. But you still could win. So really, right now, I'm balancing the risk versus reward. And the problem with the risk here is betting big and being out of position, taking over aggression in the hand. People are going to expect you to c-bet. So, and you're probably going to miss this flop because you almost always miss this flop, right? And so then you're going to have the choice of c-betting. And now that you made the pot big, that c-bet's going to be bigger, right? And yeah. You have the opportunity for one of these people that called you to raise you with anything just to see whether you have it, going back to the O'Malley's thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got to be stuck. And now you're stuck a big chunk of your stack here out of position. Or obviously you're hoping that you hit this flop and that you don't have to worry about it. But that's the problem, I think. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. We lose some advantage by not raising here. But I think what I'm trying to do is mitigate risk versus reward. I think this is a hand that's got high reward potential. And if I'm only risking 50 for it, that's fine.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I'm totally fine with that. And you have a different ability than I do when it comes to playing the limit hold'em. You know, where you have that ability to fold when it comes to stuff like, you know, this, where you're limping along, you may have hit it, but you'll get away from it. Whereas I'd rather be, you know, hey, I'd rather go up against one person and overpower them.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's just different styles. So that's the beauty of us doing this together all the time,
right.
Is that we have
exactly, different, absolutely.
And I could see myself limping once in a while with this hand. It's just that the whole hand now, if I had four opponents, I'm never going to be comfortable at all in this hand, no matter what happens. And if someone bets, then I'm going to be calling them down the rest of the way. And then it turns out, you know, I had no position, no advantage at all. And it probably cost me the same amount by the end of the hand. And I lost rather than what I would have raised with and maybe taken it. And won.
Hence,
you know?
Yeah,
I'm
right.
Just saying it could have. I just don't like those scenarios. I like to just have fewer. You know, I like to go back to Lee Childs when he says, make as few decisions as possible. That you know, don't want to make bad decisions. You know what I mean? So to
exactly.
Me,
I think that's what's funny about this is we both thought that same piece of advice, which is correct, I think, but we're interpreting it differently.
Well,
we?
For me, yeah, okay. So you're saving money as the decision, but for me. You are going to be faced with a lot more decisions than I am.
Maybe. I mean, we've already established that we play differently. So
right.
The way you play, yes, I would be facing a lot of decisions. The way I play, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean...
But again, it's a personal...
Right, but to me, you have right. More decisions in a sense that you have more people. So you have more acting people
yeah,
acting
right.
Behind
but,
you.
But at this point, I've turned this hand almost into a set mining situation.
Yeah,
almost the same as if I have a small pair here, right?
But then, are you losing equity in the fact that you have ace queen?
Oh, absolutely, you are. Absolutely,
yeah.
I fully admit that I am losing some equity by playing it this way. But I'm comfortable with that because I'm out of position with the hand that could get me in trouble, and I'd rather risk losing that equity than I would risk losing my stack, being out of position, and being forced to commit even more after the flop.
Yeah.
With a hand that's likely going to miss. Or if it hits, might still be vulnerable. I mean, if you hit an ace here, you're still vulnerable, right?
Yeah, you're always vulnerable with ace-queen. You know?
Right, exactly. And that's the other thing. I mean, how much money have we all collectively lost with ace-queen?
Yeah.
I would not fault somebody for folding this. I think that's the wrong play, but I would not fault them for it. I mean, you're out of position. It's an unraised pot, which is always scary, right?
Yeah.
And, you know... Because if what you're saying to me is, Scott, you're wasting 50 by putting by limping, I get that. And I would say if that's the case, then I'm going to fold then. I'd rather do that than put 1,200 raise in here. Because, again, I don't think the 750 raise is effective this tournament.
The only thing that would embolden me here is that I wouldn't be afraid of the queen anymore because ace-king would raise before me. There's no
right.
Way ace-king limps in this tournament. At that rate.
But another ace probably would. And
right, another ace might. But ace king...
And you're going to kill yourself if you lose this hand to ace four.
Right, right.
Because he hits his four, you
right,
know?
Right, But if you raised, the ace four wouldn't be in the hand. That's what I'm saying. That's why
I hate
the limp.
It's just an, I don't know where these players were. I don't think he said, right? But let's say one of them was on the button. In a limped pot, in a deep stack tournament like this, I'm going to call with ace four suited.
Yeah, limped. But I'm saying if I raise my ace queen and I raise it to 1,000, he's not calling with ace four.
To 1,000, no. 750, which is what we originally talked, or 550, which would have been my raise because I do Jonathan Little's bet sizing.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, the person's still going to call because that raise is not effective. Is what I'm saying. So that guy's still in. That goes back to the original thing here. Is I think you got to bet larger, 1,200 to get your desired effect. And if you do, that's great. But you're still, if you get down, even if you have one opponent left, you still got one opponent left, and you're going to be out of position against them the entire hand.
Well, I just want to clarify one thing. You said it wouldn't be effective, and that's the way I totally disagree with that. Yeah, you said less effective, but it's still effective, so we don't know if it wouldn't get out on ace four. I think it would.
Right.
But again, that's why I went 750, because I thought it would have to be. I mean, to me, if someone's going to call 750 after calling 100, they would have raised. It feels like they would raise with their hand. It's not that kind of a hand. It's not
in
like
the normal
it's 200
tournament,
or 300.
Yes. But again, I keep going back to the monster stack here. Because Jonathan's right. This tournament did phenomenal business, right? I don't know how many people entered, but people were really looking forward to it, right?
Yeah.
And it's not that you had pros from around the world that showed up just to play this, right?
Right.
This is amateurs. These are people who are like, hey, I'm going to go out just like you and I did years ago. 1,500 is well beyond my bankroll, but I'm going to say I played in the World Series, and this is the tournament I'm going to play in because I got 15,000 in chips and it's going to give me some time to play, right?
Yeah.
And those are the type of players that are going to see that raise and not think anything of it because that's what they do in their 15,000 unit chips back in Florida, Iowa, Oklahoma, wherever they come from. How many times do you see that? That you make what you think is a substantial raise and then some guy calls with queen three suited and just said, hey, well, it was only 750. I've got 15,000 chips. it happens a lot.
And I feel bad for Jason Kubi here because we're talking about so many of them haven't gotten to the hand yet. But do you think that there are that many people that are still entering $1,500 events that are that bad?
This
many years in, you still think that? Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, I'm not around it anymore. I haven't played in it since 07. So,
no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm still making a 750. I still think it's effective. But I hear your side of it. I don't think I couldn't fold this hand because there's no way Ace-King's out there. So
exactly.
I got the best ace possible, so I have to play.
But I would say I think you and I have given two very viable ways of playing.
Absolutely.
See what happens.
Yeah, okay.
That's valuable, right? All right, so our hero raises to 450, which admittedly, if I'm doing Jonathan Little, which is 2.5x plus 1 for each limper, it's actually 550. So I think the 450 is way low. 450, I think, is really a bad race, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not doing anything. It's certainly not getting anybody out. And now you've just committed. I mean, at that point, you might as well have limped, right?
Yeah.
That 400 is a waste, I think.
And you're actually building a pot for someone to have the right odds to play the hand out.
Exactly. I think at that point, you need either limp or raise more substantially. But we'll see. The big blind folds, the others all call.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that all the three limpers called, which quickly bloated the pot to 1,900. And I will say, I don't know why you're surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, 450 is really not a big raise, and again, we got 15,000 chips in front of us. It's almost like a min raise. All right, the flop is ace x, jack of clubs and six of clubs. So two clubs and ace high, and of course we have ace queen. And I think this is the worst thing that can happen, right?
Yeah.
This is why people lose money with ace queen, because they hit that ace, and you're right. It's unlikely that there's an ace king. It's possible there's an ace jack out there.
Yeah.
And possible there's an ace six, and of course we got two more cards to come, and it's more possible there's an ace, whichever one of those two cards is. So.
And there's possible six
two
six.
Clubs. Yep.
And two clubs.
That's true.
Yep. Two clubs. Even something like king queen is in there, or queen king.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Right.
Or what I say, king queen and queen jack, or queen 10. There are easily people love to play paint cards. So you've now forced nobody out, and you can't put them on any kind of hand now.
Exactly. And you're out of position, and people are looking to you to bet here. And if you don't, which is fine, then you lose aggression. So that's what's tough, right?
Yeah. See, this is what's difficult about doing Hand of the Week, because we literally have three scenarios now. We have the one where you limped, we have the one where I make it 750, or the one where you make it 1,000, and then we have what this guy did, and it's hard for me to say. If I was in, now I have to reset everything,
right,
and go back into what his position is, and I hate it, because I would not have wanted to be against four other people and raised 450 pre-flop, or three other people, whatever it is. So, I mean, to me, it's just so difficult to play the hand now. And because you didn't make it enough, you didn't, like, for you, I want to me, it's the equivalent of limping. Okay.
Right.
So yep. I want to hear what you would do, because.
Yeah, exactly. Because this is a good scenario if I would have limped.
Yeah, because it'd be a lot less money in the pot, too. So now you're not risking so much of your stack.
Because I hit my hand. It's not how I wanted to hit it. I would rather hit my queen. But I didn't bloat the pot, so I'm not on the hook for a lot. And I can play this a lot of different ways. And I'm going to treat. I'm going to treat his raise to 450 almost the same as a limp, other than the fact that I took aggression, so I got to do something, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the one positive of only raising the 450 is, even though we said the pot quickly got bloated to 1900, I think even if we raised 750, we probably wouldn't have lost anybody. If we lost one player, it's still going to be the same, right? So, so the pot isn't as big as it could have been. So that's good for us, right? The only difference between him raising 450 and me limping is now I feel like I got a bet here.
Right.
And that's fine, because I hit my ace, but I would rather have my hand disguised. I mean, imagine how powerful your ace-queen now is if you had limped. No one's going to put you on ace-queen, right? Because who limps ace-queen?
Right.
But now we race, and now people have got to legitimately put us on an ace, which is fine, because now if you've got, like, any kind of smaller pair or anything like that, the ace is a brutal card for you, right?
Right.
For those players, not you. So if you bet now, people are going to fold. I mean, this last trip to Thunder Valley, I can't tell you how many times I had a small pair, the ace came, I bet that everybody folded. Because that ace is such a scare card, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's our advantage here. So we got a bet here. I mean, it's a monster stack again, so you got to bet something substantial. So I got to bet at least half the pot here, I think. Probably more, because it's suited, so... You know, at 950s half, so I think you got to bet like 1,200, 1,300 here, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is starting with what he did, I have to bet that much. So now, and I will continue to disagree with you that the 750 would have got, I think it would have gotten more than just a big blind out. I really do.
I probably would have got one of the limpers out.
Yeah.
But I mean, do the math. I mean, it the pot's going to be roughly the same. Had one limper folded, but the other two called 300 additional,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the pot's still going to be roughly the same.
No, I know, but I mean fewer opponents.
It's a whole different thing. Absolutely.
But yeah, going with what he's in now, you said what, 12, 13? I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Some about 1,300 or so. Yeah, I would agree.
Now, if you limp, now you have the ability of playing this differently. You don't have to make that big bet right there. You don't have to take charge here. I'm not saying you wouldn't, but I'm saying you have the option of not. And since I limped and I only have 50 committed to this hand voluntarily, I might try to see how the hand develops. I might check here and see if somebody wants to take a stab, and I'll probably call and, you know, I guess technically semi-float and maybe come alive later. And if club comes, then I can shut it down. And I still ain't committed to 50. Or I can bet out. So I got more options, I think, by limping than I did if by making this very smallish raise.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that all depends on your ability to be able to fold this hand at some point.
Yeah.
And you're right. Your personality doesn't allow, your playing style doesn't allow you to fold that, so you should never play the way I play.
Yeah, no, it's just, they're just different, and we both have success with the way we
but
play.
But if you're capable of folding this, I think you've got a lot of options here.
Yeah.
Had you limped pre-flop.
Right.
But we didn't, so
we didn't,
yeah.
So it's 1,200, 1,300 or so we put in the middle. What does he do?
All right, so he says, I figure I'm best at this point, and I want to chase away any flush draws, so I bet 1,400 into the 1,900 pot.
That's okay, I guess.
That's the same, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Of the three players still in the hand, the middle guy calls. He is in his late 50s with a heavy European accent. He's been one of the more active players and has called down with top pair weak kicker a few times, including ace-5 offsuit, king-6 suited, and queen-10 suited. He's been up and down, and currently started the hand with just a few hundred more than us. So he has us covered, but within the field out. So we're heads up now.
We're heads up, And when you tell me that he's called down with top pair weak kicker, that really doesn't help me because I don't know if that was a raised pot when he was in those hands. So that stuff really doesn't help unless you know.
But I guess the personality is that he's willing to call weak.
Yeah, he's willing to call weak, but I just
Which
don't know if he
good
started
for
weak.
Situation.
Yeah. Unless he has ace crap and hits his crap.
That's the big risk here, right?
Yeah, yep. That's the risk.
He obviously has shown down crap hands, so
yeah.
He very likely could have ace six here. He could have, if the deuce comes, he could have ace deuce. You know, a nine comes, he could have ace nine. You don't know. That's
yeah.
the problem.
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. He says, at this point, I put the villain on a weak ace or flush draw, though we do have the ace of clubs. The villain probably would have raised ace-jack pre-flop, and he's probably folding small pocket pairs at this point since I continue Asian bet with three more players to act. In other words, I don't think he's floating a small pocket pair because he's got to give me credit for something, though obviously 6-6 is still a possibility.
Right. I have nothing to say. Sure. I mean, again, if you don't know...
But he could
know,
have anything, really.
Right, he could have anything, so...
I mean, it's tough not to have anything and call with this 1,200, but again... I mean, this goes back to the O'Malley. I mean, obviously, the more aggressive player, he might have raised us to find out whether we really have something.
Right.
But you could also call, and then... Because here's what's going to happen. I mean, if you use the Lee Childs thing, you probably... Well, it's tough now because of two clubs. You're probably not going to check the flop yourself. I mean, the turn.
Right.
But generally speaking, for pot control, you probably would. And that gives him an opportunity to play back at you on the turn.
Right.
All right, we'll see what happens. Pot's now 4,700, and the turn is a non-club X, obviously. So now we're at ace, jack, six, ace with two clubs.
Oh, an ace came on the turn.
Yep.
Okay. So we have three aces, second best kicker, and...
Well, aside from the boat, kickers.
Kickers. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, kickers.
Right, yeah.
It's 47 in the pot? You said 4,700?
47.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe 3,500, because we don't have a boat. So, I mean, we could be against flush draws. We still could be against another random ace, you know. I don't feel like we're behind. I don't feel like checking here. I really think I need to put my foot down now, and maybe 3,500.
Yeah, I would argue, I'm fine with that. That's probably what I do. But I'd argue you do have the option now, even the way he played it, to check this turn.
And what, call anything on the river?
Well, or call whatever, if he bets on the turn here, I would call, maybe raise even. And the same on the river. I mean, obviously, the risk you take, two risks you take in checking here. One, if he's on a club draw, you give him an opportunity to get there, which sucks. Right. But now that we've got three aces, there's a possibility that we could boat up with that flush hits, right? So.
Right.
That's mitigated somewhat. And then obviously the value you lose if he's got a weaker ace that obviously he would call here. So those are things that I'd have to consider. But I think you have the option now of saying, of almost acting like that ace scared you when really you're really excited about it, right?
Yeah.
And see whether he makes a mistake there. Plus, you know, you got some pot control to here. Maybe you'll set the price differently by that. Because it's probably unlikely that he's going to bet, what would you say, 3,500 is what
yeah.
you had to bet?
Yeah.
It's probably unlikely that he would bet that. But if not, you're letting him set the price, and that's fine because you've got what you think is the best hand here, right?
So let me ask you, if we check and then he bets a nominal amount, like $2,000, and we call and then check the river, if it doesn't give us a boat?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I might come out and I'm not going to let him bet my hand for me.
Defensive bet, though?
Yeah, I would probably put out a bet that I want to get called.
Okay. Sure. All right.
And if that all works out, that whole scenario works out, people are legitimately allowed to say, Scott, you lost value on that hand. And I would say yes. But I think it's a creative way of playing it.
Right.
I mean, the risk right now is if we really are up against A6, is that we're betting into a boat, right? And I mean, so here's the problem is when we bet here, what happens if he raises?
Right.
Now we got to figure out whether he has A6 and we're crushed. But he could also be raising if he has Ace X, right? Which
right.
we have crushed.
Right.
You know.
It feels like if he raises us, he doesn't have a boat, Because if he has a boat, why would he raise us now? Is he really only protecting against us making a boat? I mean, so I would feel like a raise here. We're ahead, and I'm going to shove on the guy.
Okay. And if he has an ace, he's going to call, right?
Yeah.
So that's good. I'm not complaining about that. But he probably has a dangler here, and now it's a battle on the river to see who hits their kicker, right?
Yeah.
And so the problem I have with that is we're in level 3 of a monster stack tournament.
Yeah.
And I really don't want to get my whole stack in that early in this kind of tournament ever, unless I've got like the nuts, and we don't have the nuts here, right?
Right.
So that's the risk in that. But you're probably right. I mean, I'm not going to have to go that way. But again, that's where we get started in this hand if that happens. And then that's one of those things, if he had A6 or has A5 and a 5 comes on the river and you're out of the tournament and you're walking away shaking your head, oh my gosh, how can I be out of a 15,000 unit tournament in the third level?
Third level.
And it's because, you know, we played Ace-Queen the way we played it.
Yeah.
Pre-flop.
Yeah.
All right. So the pot is 4,700. We hit our turn card here, and we decide to bet 2,200.
Hmm.
And he raises to 5,400.
Wow.
So exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, here. So now I just can't imagine just... Can you imagine just calling, though? I just can't imagine calling.
Can, and here's the reason why, is because, again, it might prevent me from being felted.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I mean, he has an ace. He's still going to... Right, exactly. But at that point, then I've got another choice at that point. I mean, the option that you talked about, which I think makes sense, too, is shoving here. If I shove, I'm committing myself to, you know, hoping that I'm right and hoping that my hand holds up on the river.
Right.
Whereas if I don't shove, then I'm not at risk yet. It's very likely I'm going to be at risk on the river. But at least I have an option.
You couldn't possibly fold, though.
No, I could.
For 3,200 more?
I'm not saying I would. I'm like, I could. Because here, again, I mean, so you're right. Here's the point at this point is that we've got three aces. And if we call here, you know, we're down to...
9?
6,000?
Oh, if we call. Yeah, down right? to 6, yeah.
Are we really going to fold this hand for that pot that's well bigger than 6,000? With three aces, or are we going to risk being knocked out of this tournament? And I don't think we're going to do that. I think the money's going to get on the river anyhow if we call here, right? So if that's the case, we might as well just shove, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And then if that's the case, then we're back in the scenario I talked about. We'll get our life on the line in level 3 of a 15,000 unit tournament.
Mm. Hence,
and really don't know where we are. We really don't know where we are, right?
This is the reason why people tell bad beat stories, because they want to legitimize the fact that they went out in a 15,000 chip unit, you know, whatever tournament in the third level, because they want to legitimize how they, you know, how they play. They don't want people to think they suck. Because here's the reason why I went out so early in the tournament, you know, because
and lots of places are going to sympathize with them here. Huh? Yeah. You had three aces? Oh my God, that's a cooler.
Yeah.
And it very well may be. I don't know how the hand's going to play out. It very well may be. But it also could be that we played this suboptimally from the beginning.
Yeah.
And got us into a situation where all of our chips ended up being in the pot way earlier in this tournament than they should have.
Yeah. All right.
So I don't know. I mean, again, this is always what sucks about being out of position.
Yep, absolutely. Which is why you either want to... This is why I don't like to just limp. But again, you're playing for smaller amounts if you limp, and exactly. You can make easier decisions.
Because now we're talking about stacks here, right?
Yeah, now we're talking about stacks.
Had we limped, I don't think it's possible, but I don't think we would have got to the point in this hand where we're talking about stacks.
Yeah. Probably not. All right, well, I'm shoving.
Of course, right?
Yeah.
All right, so our hero says, now I'm definitely not putting him on the club draw. He has to have an ace. The only hands that beat me are ace-king, ace-jack, ace-six, or six-six.
Jack-jack beats you.
Oh, that's true. He's, I have already eliminated the first two from his range. Six-six probably would have also raised me on the flop because of potential flush draws that either the person have left that could be chasing. So he's really put him down to only ace-six that can beat him.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I feel like we're either ahead, or we could have the same hand. I mean, who knows? He could have ace queen.
Could be, yeah.
But or ace 10, and we're ahead. So, I feel like we're ahead. I don't mind shoving here. It just feels like we're ahead. If we were behind, he would have just called. And he would say, go ahead, bet again on the river. And if not, I have position, I'll bet on the river. So why would he raise us if he wasn't trying to protect his hand or whatever? You know, I mean, of course, he is the kind of guy who just said played king six suited. So I don't know what kind of player he is, but clearly if he's playing those hands for raises or even limping with them, he's not a good player. So maybe he doesn't understand the value of his hand. I don't know. But I don't see the reason to raise there unless you have a susceptible hand rather mm-hmm. than a nuts or something. So I feel like we're ahead and I'm going to shove. I can't call here because then what am I going to do, check the river, and then he shoves? I'm going to call anyway. So,
well, if you call and you check and he checks behind, then, you know. But, I mean, at that point, he's only got to check behind if – well, I shouldn't say – I shouldn't say he's only got to check behind. If he's got a lower ace and
– he might be nervous.
And we called, then he's like – now he's got to think that we've got one of these hands that we're talking about he might have, right?
Yeah.
Plus a hand like we have that it's a higher kicker. So it is possible for us to call here, check the river, and have him check behind and still win this pot.
Yeah, and save some money at the end.
Which probably, the more I think about it, is probably the way to do in this big tournament. Because even with 6,000, we still got a gajillion big blinds, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Actually, I think that's probably the way I would go.
So you think you'd call and then check the river?
Take the shot that either I hit my queen, which would be great, or the case ace, which is not coming because he has it, right? Probably.
Or at least a jack to make a...
something like that, right? Yeah. And then feel more emboldened about getting my chips in, or hoping that I get to get down to showdown without putting my life on the line.
Yeah
absolutely. It's probably not going to happen. You're right. You know, he's probably going to put you all in. But that's no different than raising. I mean, raising here is not going to get the guy to fold, is it?
I don't know. Maybe not. If I have 6,000 more on top of it, it might.
Because he's committed way more to this hand than we have right now.
At this point, yeah. Well, 3,000 more.
And we're already saying that we can't get away from this hand. So if we shove here, I don't think he can get away from it, regardless of what his ace is. So calling gives us an option of still staying alive in here.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
It is. Yeah, I don't know what the right word is, but it is interesting.
I feel like we're ahead, though. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe I got to get away from this if I know I'm ahead, getting all my money in ahead, because it never ends up very good for me. I know I'm ahead, and I still lose. And then you walk away, and they say, well, at least you got your money in good. You know, that doesn't get me a cup of coffee. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. Well, think about the scenario here. I mean, if you do get it in good, which is great, but he biffs you on the river, or you actually don't have it good, and you don't catch up, you're out, right?
Yeah.
If you just call here and still win the hand, the way we're talking, you know, so you lost a little bit of value, but monster stack, you're set up pretty well with what you're going to win here, right?
Yeah.
So that's not fatal. It's not bad. And you have the option of him just checking behind, and if he has, you know, I don't know what he could have. I mean, maybe he has ace king, which doesn't make any sense. You know, but a hand where he doesn't feel comfortable betting, but still has you beat, then you're still alive, and you've got a lot of chips.
Yeah. That's interesting. Interesting angle.
This scenario, I don't see much value in shoving now that I think about it.
All right. All right. Let's see what he did.
All right. Well, our hero called. And did I already say that?
Yeah, you said you called. I just want to see the turn.
All right, so the pot is 15,500, and the river is ace X. So the flush didn't get there.
You said ace X.
Eight X.
You do that a lot. Okay, so 8X. So it's no clubs.
Ace Jack 8-6 is final.
Okay. So there's two aces, Jack 8-6, and no.
Doesn't change much for us unless he was hanging around with ace eight. Now he's beat us.
Well, I think we've given our answer then, since you've already talked about it. We said that we would probably check and see if this guy checks behind and we're happy with the pot. And if he bets at all, we have to put ourselves to a decision and probably can't fold three aces. So I guess we'll just check and see what happens.
See what happens, right? All right, well, our hero tanks for 30 seconds or so and then shoves his remaining 58-50.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, like, you got three aces. You got a real good kicker. They never could put you on that. If the guy backdoored into a boat or... if he flopped a boat and he just played it weird, not flopped a boat, flopped a set and then turned a boat and played it weird, then, you know, good for him. I think we saw both ways of this. It could be a check call, it could be a check, and it could be, you know, shove on your own if you want. But if you're going to shove there, why didn't you shove before? I mean, you're really just waiting for a chance to check? I mean,
I'm not trying to pick on Jason's friend here, but I don't like this move here. I think the only genius I can see in this move is that it looks like we're bluffing and hoping that he catches us in a bluff.
Yeah, because all we're doing really is now it's a bluff catcher, what we have. Because,
yeah, and then have him, like, you know, maybe he didn't have an ace at all and thinks, oh my god, now he's shoving here, so it does look bluffish. But I think if you're going to bet here, I mean, you've got 58-50, I mean, save some bus fare, right?
I don't know about that. The pot's huge.
Yeah, but I mean, a small bet almost looks like you want to be called anyhow, right? So sometimes that small bet succeeds in getting the guy to fold because it looks like, you know, that's the weird thing about poker, I think, is big bets sometimes are easier for folks to call than small bets.
Yeah.
Because of what the story you're telling at that point.
There's just so much in the pot, though.
But yeah,
what amount could you bet that would make it
look
like? I
couldn't bet anything here, so really, yeah. Really, I'd check and let him shove on me, and then I got a call.
Yeah, I would never shove
there
now.
Hope that doesn't shove.
Given what happened up to this point, I would never shove now.
And if he's got a better hand than us, he's probably not going to shove here unless he really thinks we're going to call, right?
Yeah.
And you got to think about that because, again, you got to give him credit for thinking what I'm talking about, that we're in level 3 of a 15,000-unit tournament, and is this guy really going to want to go out here?
Right.
So I'm probably not going to succeed in getting him to call my shove, so I'm going to bet something I think he will call, 2,000 or something like that. And if that's the case, and we put 2,000 in, we win the pot, yay, we're all happy. The only thing we did is lose 3,000 in equity in a massive chip tournament, which I can live with. Or if he's got me beat, guess what? I'm still alive.
Yeah.
3,000-4,000 in chips, which sucks, but it's still plenty of chips in this format.
Okay, what happened?
I'd much rather do that, I think.
Show's getting extended tomorrow. This is the long version of the show.
It's a good hand of the week.
It's a director's cut.
Director's cut. All right, so the villain snap calls, shrugs, and says sorry. Flips over ace-8 for a river fold.
Oh, he rivered it. Yeah, it's exactly what we thought the hand was.
Yeah. And we did get unlucky there, and I would give Jason's friend credit for a great story, but I think treating it differently from the beginning probably would have avoided this end result.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because your limp would have cost him less money the whole way. He'd still be around. Unless the guy went crazy and bet a ton on the end. And then my way may have gotten the ace-8 to fold. Who knows?
Exactly. Yep.
So, I mean, not to be results-oriented, but you guys got to play it a little more properly, I guess is the word. But that's brutal. But
I mean, it's really tough, I think, pre-flop to play the whole hand out at that point. But I think you got to at least think about where you're going to end up in that hand when you play. And when I'm in the small blind, I'm always thinking the entire hand at that point.
Yeah.
Because I know, the one thing I know for sure is I'm going to be out of position the entire hand. You know, anywhere else on the table, it's possible that somebody might fold and I might pick up position on someone.
Yeah.
Small blind, you know.
You're always last.
There's nobody that's going to take over that position for you unless you, like, win the hand, which is great. But
And the worst part for this guy now on top of this is that he doesn't even get to enjoy the J Design playing cards. His buddy tags on it.
Yeah, that's right.
And Jason gets the card. The guy who loses $1,500 still doesn't get anything for it. Sorry, pal.
I love it.
All right, Jason, thanks for sending that hand. Really appreciate it. And another good show. This has been Daily Affirmation with Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Stuart Smalley.
We'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.